Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. A mass shooting in Las Vegas shocks a nation weary of waking up to news of senseless murder, and New Hampshire politicians react. A woman accused of animal cruelty after dozens of Great Danes were removed from her mansion has her day in court, and a VA whistleblower throws his hat into the ring to challenge Annie Custer in New Hampshire's 2nd District. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour, and we'd like you to lend your voice to this conversation. What about this week's news do you want to know? What perspective can you share that will help your fellow listeners understand the issues? You can call into The Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's digital engagement producer, Dan Tuohy. And we're going to start the show by talking about Las Vegas and the ensuing discussion about guns and gun control. Again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to this part of the conversation is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear from you about your reaction to Las Vegas and, of course, that conversation that follows all these mass shootings that we've been hearing about in the news in the past few years, the conversation about gun control. So we woke up on Monday morning to news that more than 50 people had been killed by a gunman shooting from a hotel window onto a crowd. Hundreds were hurt, and it's hard to make words do justice to how horrific the situation was. But words, in fact, did matter after this attack, and Senator Jeanne Shaheen called it terrorism. President Trump didn't come right out and call it terrorism right away. We'll go to you first, Dean. What is this? Is this terrorism or is this something else?
It's certainly a tremendous tragedy. I don't know that I'll be the final arbiter on whether or not this is terrorism, but this debate that has bubbled up, particularly on social media, about whether or not this is terrorism, President Trump's tendency to quickly label other types of mass casualty incidents terrorism based on the kind of race or ethnicity of the shooter and their, you know, their origins, et cetera. And this time not coming out immediately saying it was you have a white American shooter. You know, has raised some debate on Twitter. You know, some people believe for it to be terrorism, there needs to be an ideological component. You need some evidence that the individual was radicalized in some way. You know, typically in recent cases, we look for connections to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, and I'm certainly the law enforcement and legal and authorities are doing that. But yeah, this is, you know, this is, in some sense, it seems sort of like given the magnitude of the tragedy, it seems almost like a little bit of an academic debate, but there are some implications for policy down the road. And again, there has been some criticism of President Trump that with other types of mass casualty incidents, given the sort of race, ethnicity, and origins of the shooter, he was very quick to label it terrorism. In this case, because we're dealing with a white American citizen, he sort of held back. That is what drove a lot of the debate on on social media. And but, you know, I think they're still in the process of piecing together the backstory of all this.
OK, yeah. Quickly politicized, Dan.
Well, definitely it's terror, but is it the legal definition of terrorism? There is a code out there, the U.S. code, that talks about that ideological, political motive of the terrorist in this case. You know, it's interesting to see the NRA coming out here on the bump stocks that would make these weapons, a semi-automatic weapon, into a more of a fully automatic weapon. They asked for the government to review whether this is a possible change in the how it's complied with federal law. And notably, they said, you know, the device is designed to allow semi-automatic rifles to function like fully automatic rifles. Should be, and I'm quoting from the statement, should be subject to additional regulations. It's interesting because, it's, you know, Senator Hassan has thrown her support behind a bill to ban these devices, and we'll see how far that gets on.
The NRA's, that's a strategy there. They want, NRA wants the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau to look into possible further regulation or banning of these stocks. They don't want to go to a legislative process because they view that as a slippery slope to larger gun control debate. So I think they felt like they didn't have a choice given the magnitude of this tragedy and the fact that most people had never even heard of these devices before. But there is some strategy there by going to a regulatory agency rather than letting this go through a legislative process. I think they're trying to get out ahead of the debate in Congress.
And let's not forget what the bump stocks do. I mean, these take semi-automatic weapons and they turn them essentially into fully automatic weapons. And anyone who heard the tapes of Vegas, I mean, even some experienced shooters that who we talked to, either didn't know what a bump stock was. You know, the Speaker of the House said that himself. Or experienced shooters heard that and thought that was a fully auto because of the way the bump stock works. The bump stock works. And even the NRA in their own headquarters, they have a shooting range there. They don't allow bump stocks at that range just because of how difficult it makes the firearm to handle. So, you know, I think that this is something that will probably get looked at.
Mm-hmm. Were the responses from our elected leaders, both the congressional delegation and Governor Chris Sununu, sort of predictable based on party lines? Dean, do you think?
Well, you mean in terms of the reaction of what to do about the bump stocks specifically?
We'll say in general that Democrats, when this happens, come out and say, we need more gun control, sure. And Republicans say X. And is that predictable?
I mean, you saw Republicans pretty much across the board, at least initially, say, you know, now is not the time to have the debate over gun control because we're dealing with this tragedy. Democrats, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of sort of very passionate statements on Twitter and elsewhere from Democrats saying that, you know, that thoughts and prayers are important, but now is the time to also take action. So, yeah, it was fairly predictable, although we are seeing with this particular issue of these stocks, some movement by Republicans to get on board with banning these things. Now, whether that's an attempt to kind of do something so that they can kind of put off the larger debate about background checks and high capacity magazines that we had after Newtown, we'll see. But in any event, it seems like there will, you know, something may happen, but it's very difficult. I mean, think about the Newtown shooting in 2012, early 2013, we have a debate in Congress about background checks, high capacity magazines. You have a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate goes Republican in 2014, and they couldn't get anything through. So we may see movement on this bump stock issue, but it's not clear how successful, given the current partisan dynamics in Congress, that there'll be much more than that.
Yeah, we interviewed a Second Amendment advocate yesterday here in New Hampshire who called this a knee-jerk reaction. And you hear that sometimes from about gun control after a major shooting. It is one piece of what was a horrific tragedy in Las Vegas, and we'll be hearing more about this for weeks.
Yeah, certainly the gun control debate has not really begun in earnest yet, but well, I'm sure there'll be more to come on that. Let's talk a little bit more about Governor Sununu. This is, again, not entirely surprising, but Governor Sununu said he will run for re-election in 2018. Speaking on Wednesday, he said he likes the job as governor, but he's not a huge fan of the way people talk about politics these days.
It was a lot easier when my father was governor, right? There was no social media, right? There wasn't all this acrimonious political environment. You mentioned the word politics, people cringe nowadays, right? You know, people are afraid to stand up on their values because they're afraid they'll be judged for being a liberal or a conservative or a Democrat or a Republican. That's a horrible way to be.
and yet he's still going to be a politician. He'll be running for governor. Dean, not an entirely surprising thing, in part because governors usually run for re-election after their first term, and they, in recent history, win, usually.
Yeah, I think, well, for most of our modern history, certainly here in New Hampshire, now you have a two-year term as governor. That's unusual. It's not typical in the U.S. It's typically 4 years. And so you really kind of just sort of feel like you're just getting started and getting a feel for the job, and then you already have to run for re-election. You know, we have a tradition in the state of typically giving governors at least a second term. The one exception is Governor Benson, and I think that's in a 90-year period or something like that. So it's very rare that governors don't get a second term. He's very popular right now. He seems to kind of understand increasingly how to position himself to bring in some independents and moderates, despite doing some things that were quite conservative. It's going to be a tough race for anyone who challenges him as of now. You know, things could certainly change within a year, but right now, you know, typically you would expect that someone in this position would be reelected, but, you know, things could change.
Right. Perhaps the real news would have been if he said he wasn't running for reelection, right? The other piece of news out of there was he teased us yet again about the Amazon 2, the headquarters proposal for New Hampshire.
I thought we were going to get through this week without talking about Amazon, but go ahead.
Well, it was really interesting. He was talking, you know, to a business crowd at the Bedford Village Inn and says, well, soon, in another week or two, the state's proposal for this, as the governor said, will shock people, quote unquote.
Huh.
So we will see.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
All right. And in the meantime, Governor Sununu also went to Washington this week to meet with President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence. Trent, what was he talking about with the president?
He was there just as some of this Vegas news was breaking. He was invited along with four other governors, including the governor of Maine and Mississippi and Kentucky, to talk about ways that the federal government could model some of the regulation slashing that these governors have been doing in their home states. So it was set up as a day of meetings. The president and our governor met, and they talked about some ideas. One of the big things that our governor brought up was the way the federal government targets money, especially when it comes to the opioid epidemic. He brought up an example that there was a recent round of funding where about $60 million was appropriated by Congress, and New Hampshire got $400,000 out of the almost $60 million. This is obviously the center of the opioid epidemic, but because of the way the federal government uses different ratios, the way they use populations, New Hampshire wasn't able to get as much money as other states, bigger states, even though the other bigger states have a lower per capita opioid issue. So that's one thing that he was really asking the president to change. And the president said, according to the governor, that he was open to that.
Mm-hmm. And out of that meeting, the headline was in some ways that Governor Sununu was really enamored with the way President Trump was handling things with respect to regulation.
Yeah, well, he said it was refreshing. He found the President Trump's approach refreshing. You know, this is something, if you talk to people who are closely watching the Trump administration, you know, for all of President Trump's difficulty in passing major pieces of legislation, whether it's health care or we'll see about tax reform or infrastructure, which has largely fallen off of the radar, they are doing a lot in the agencies, in the cabinet departments to roll back regulations in the environment, energy, and a variety of other areas that give concern to progressive activists who follow these issues closely. So you do have a potential to make a lot of changes in the executive branch, despite maybe not having success with big legislative packages. And I think so far that's where Trump has been having his greatest impact in the actual process of deregulating through the federal bureaucracy.
Meanwhile, we have the congressional delegation calling on the White House to make this declare it a national emergency, the opioid epidemic, of course. And, you know, when the governor has a chance to sit down with the vice president or the president, you take it. I'm sure the governor is, again, reminding or pitching to get more flexibility to work with Medicaid dollars, whether it's for health care or, again, you know, substance abuse treatment.
Mm-hmm. And worth mentioning that, you know, months ago, the president called New Hampshire a drug-infested den. This comment did not come up during the president's meeting with the governor.
I don't believe so.
No. And and just one final point on this is that WMUR quoted the governor as saying there is nothing political about deregulation. Thoughts about this comment from you gentlemen? Dean?
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. I mean, you know, from my point of view, that presidents come into office, they're allowed to kind of replace the sort of top level of the bureaucracy as a means of enforcing their particular agenda or ideological worldview. Ronald Reagan did it famously in the early 1980s, sort of going way down into the bureaucracy to put people in place who brought about his view of shifting resources from domestic programs, the Great Society, to national security. And so presidents can have a tremendous ideological impact through the bureaucracy. I think we're seeing that here. I certainly wouldn't call it non-political, but maybe the governor had something else in mind when he said that.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and later in the hour, we're going to be talking about a new Republican challenge to Democrat Annie Custer in the state's 2nd Congressional District. Stuart Levinson, the VA whistleblower, is now running for Congress as a Republican. We're also going to be talking about the Supreme Court's decision not to hear a case on at-sea monitors, which may have broad implications for the Seacoast's fishing industry, the fishing industry in the entire Northeast. If you work in the fishing industry on New Hampshire's Seacoast and have experience with these at-sea monitors, give us a call. Tell us how you feel about them. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Let's switch gears a little bit here and talk about those Great Danes that were seized from the mansion in Wolfboro earlier this summer. Christina Fay, the owner of those dogs, appeared in court this week. She is facing animal cruelty charges, and she appeared in court this week to make a case for herself. Let's hear a bit of tape from court about what she had to say.
It was a large number, and not one went without excellent care, water, food, and being loved every day.
So that was her part of her defense about how she cared for the dogs. Trent, what do you make of her argument?
Well, it's interesting to see the other side of the story. You know, we tell our reporters, get all the sides of the story. And in the original story was these 75 Great Danes, some of them trapped in cages and rooms, covered in their own feces, on this million-dollar property, 45 acres in Wolfboro, this beautiful property. And we had photos, and we still have them on unionleader.com, that looked just horrendous. It looked like these animals were being completely mistreated. And now we hear the other side of the story from Mrs. Fay, who says that, you know, that the dogs, between the time that the police came and told her she had to vacate and the time that they took those pictures, several hours, and no one was taking care of the dogs. She said that some of the issues that you see in these dogs, like this cherry eye issue, which there was one, we ran this on the front page of the Union Leader. It's really sad. It looked like the dog's eye was just infected and gross, that's actually a common thing and can be fixed. You know, I'm not an expert, but it was the first time we heard from her, and she has been fighting to get her dogs back. So we'll see what happens with the judge.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Yeah, part of the argument that she made in court about those pictures is that, you know, they were taken at the worst possible moment. She also, according to NHPR's Todd Bookman, speaking to him earlier this week, said that she came to court with a stack of records of visits with the vet as part of her case that she was, in fact, taking care of these animals. But as you say, Trent, this is the first time we were able to hear that other side of the story. Dean, you've been following this story. What do you make of her appearance?
It was certainly interesting to hear her side of the story. I think they're trying to have the majority of the charges dropped in advance of trial. There is going to be a trial at the end of October, and it's going to be up to the people hearing the case to make a decision about, you know, who's telling the true story. You know, our initial understanding was that this was a really difficult scene to even enter when they went to rescue these dogs. And it is true that Great Danes have a lot of health problems. They only live 5 to 8 years, and they have issues with cherry eye and bloat and a variety of other conditions. And so, you know, she's obviously going to make the case that these things that are being labeled as problems, infections, et cetera, just a natural part of the challenges of having that particular breed. You know, we'll see. I kind of willing to sort of hear how the evidence plays out during the trial. But, you know, again, this person is being presented as a breeder and not a hoarder. She should be able to demonstrate that she had sort of a functioning breeding program and was, you know, able to sell the dogs as part of a normal kennel. I don't know what evidence there is from that. It just seems like maybe it got a little bit out of hand, but we'll see.
Another interesting thing that came up during the hearing, which I think goes to show just how ugly this whole case has become and probably how ugly the trial will get, is that Mrs. Fay accused – her attorneys accused the Humane Society of using those photos, of using the dogs that the 75 Great Danes that were taken into custody essentially as a fundraising tool. That the Humane Society had raised somewhere between $300,000 and $500,000 from various people who saw this story. The story went international. I remember when it first broke that newspapers in England were calling us asking to buy pictures that we had taken of the house. And so, you know, I think that they raised a lot of money. And Fay is saying, essentially, follow the money to see why these people have taken, you know, have said that my dogs aren't doing well and need to be taken away from me. They've raised a lot of money because of that.
And perhaps those pictures were in some ways contributing to fundraising efforts, but is there any evidence that there's a link between the Humane Society and the motivation of those who seize the dogs to seize the dogs? Is there any evidence of that? Dan, have you seen anything?
Not that we're aware of. As Dean mentioned, the trial's coming up. I believe it's October 16th is the start date over in Ossipee. You know, there's 12 charges. It's very serious. Every single charge is very serious. And we'll see. And she's got a defense team, and she's going to pitch her case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the questions I'd be interested in hearing an answer to is, you know, that she discussed, she argued in court that the dogs had excellent care, but there may be a difference between excellent care and adequate or sufficient care, right? And is that something that maybe the lawyers will be looking at?
Oh, I'm sure. The fact that there were 85 Great Danes, I think in court they said 75 European Great Danes. It's an awful lot of dogs. Does the house have the proper facilities?
Is it really built to be a kennel?
Exactly.
Looks just like she had them sort of hanging out in the house.
Right.
Okay. Let's touch on one thing, and we may have to take a break in the middle, but let's talk about Congressional District 2. Stuart Levinson is now running for Congress in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District. He was one of the whistleblowers who blew the whistle on what he called mismanagement at the Manchester VA that led to harm for some patients. And he spoke a little bit about why he decided to run. Let's hear that.
I had faith in our leaders to some extent, at least. I mean, I'm a Republican. There's a lot of issues that we differ on. But you would think on issues where we're all on the same page, taking care of our veterans, more would be done.
Stuart Levinson speaking about why he was sort of upset that more hadn't been done for the veterans at that Manchester VA. Interesting to note, Dean, that, you know, in Levinson's announcement to the press, it did not state what specifically to do about the VA, but it did talk about the other issues that any other candidate would talk about. It talked about health care, immigration, border security, partisan gridlock. Did that strike you as interesting, Dean?
Yeah, well, you know, when you're announcing a run for elected office, you want to have a platform to run on. You know, some candidates focus primarily on one issue, so he could make veterans health care his primary issue, but he also mentioned immigration and a couple of other issues as well. You know, the 2nd Congressional District is in recent years been a challenge for Republicans running for office. It has skewed slightly more Democratic in recent years, but Annie Custer, you know, won a narrow victory over Jim Lawrence the last time around. So it has the potential to be competitive, but it has been increasingly favorable for Democrats.
All right. Well, we'll have more about CD2 after the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. And if you'd like to call in and talk about what it would take maybe to flip the 2nd Congressional District in New Hampshire from blue to red, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work?
Is this system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's digital engagement producer Dan Tuohy. And it has been a busy week for reporters in New Hampshire, and now is your chance to get some answers to your questions about what's been happening in the Granite State. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking about legislation that would require presidential candidates to disclose their federal tax returns before New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary. Call us about that now to join the discussion when it starts. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And also wanted to mention that we will be needing your help for a show that we're doing next week. On Wednesday, we'll be having a discussion about gun control. We spoke about that briefly just a short time ago, but we're going to have an in-depth conversation about it on Wednesday. And you can lend your voice to that discussion now by sending an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Thank you very much in advance, by the way, for sharing your thoughts on this issue. So we spoke briefly before the break about Stuart Levinson, VA whistleblower, running for Congressional District 2 in the western, northern, and southwestern part of the state. So he's not the only Republican in the race, right? Jack Flanagan, Dean,
Jack
has
Flanagan,
already entered.
Yep, former Republican majority leader, I believe, in the House of Representatives. He's run before, lost to Jim Lawrence in the last primary. So Levinson will have to deal with him in the primary next September. But, you know, as I said, this district has been increasingly favorable to Democrats ever since former Representative Charlie Bass lost after many years, or over a decade of holding that seat. Particularly, you know, you've got Concord, you've got the Keene area, you've got the Upper Valley that have increasingly skewed Democratic, although it was a tougher race for Custer this last time in 2016 than it had been in the past. So certainly a possibility there for a competitive race.
You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of Mark Connelly, you know, the guy who ran for governor, Democrat from the Seacoast. He ran on that mortgage Ponzi scheme, and it was this narrative. And this Dr. Levinson's coming out as a whistleblower here, and he's going to be campaigning partly on that because he says, you know, healthcare is the seminal issue of our time, as you reported.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got some expertise in healthcare administration. He knows he seems to think that healthcare is going to be one of the things that Congress is going to be focusing on. And who better to focus on an issue like this than someone who's spent years and years in the medical profession? One of the things that I find interesting about this is he's aligning himself with Donald Trump in a few ways, notably on the fact that he is an outsider, that he's never been elected to political office before. And he's sort of a grassroots guy, in his words, who's trying to build things from the perspective of a private citizen who has interest in things. In your experience, Trent, how well will that argument play in CD2?
Well, that's a good question. And just following up on Dan's point, I think that I wonder if they when you asked, you know, that why didn't he bring up the whole whistleblower thing as part of his announcement? I wonder if he looked at Connolly and his race for governor and how that did the FRM whistleblower stuff just didn't play well, didn't register with voters. And so I think that I wonder if they looked at it and said, we need to come up with a full platform of what we're going to stand for, which includes all these other things. I think that in CD2, to answer your question, is I think that that district has been thought of as a Democratic stronghold this decade. But don't forget Charlie Bass. And I think that if a more moderate is able to pick up some of the votes that Custer has had now for the last three cycles, I think that there's a real challenge here. Don't forget Jim Lawrence, who ran against Custer in 2016, only lost by 16,000 votes. He had no money at all from the National Party, essentially. He had very difficult time fundraising, even in New Hampshire, because people didn't think he had a chance. He had a lot of negative publicity. And so I think that if somebody who's serious and somebody – and I think if the party's willing to spend a couple of million dollars, that this is a real race.
And, you know, Bass was very skillful at kind of tacking to the center over that 10-year period as the demographics of the district changed until 2010, when he became a Tea Partier like everybody else. And that was really his last hurrah as a congressman. It's true, Levinson's an outsider. He's never run before, which means he's never experienced being hammered relentlessly by a well-funded incumbent, which is often what happens to challengers who are new to the process. Custer's been good at raising money. They've gotten a lot of the kinks out of their organization in terms of campaign strategy over the last couple cycles, but as Trent mentioned, it was a little bit closer than usual last time. Now, some people will say, well, you know, Democrats are going to have more energy this time because of Trump in 2018. So, you know, that could help her.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit. Talk about those at-sea monitors. There was a challenge in the U.S. Supreme Court, but the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear this case brought by a Hampton fisherman over the cost of these fishing regulators. Trent, what was this case all about?
So here's the deal. If you're a small fisherman, and David Gothel from Hampton, he is, the federal government now mandates that you have to pay somebody else, an independent monitor, to come on your fishing vessel so that when you go out, they're making sure that you're following all the rules. They don't give you a hand pulling up nets. They don't give you a hand navigating or doing anything.
They just watch.
They're watching to make sure you're following all the federal regulations. And for that, you have to pay them $700 a day. He argued that this is not legal, that there's no other place where you have to pay someone else to follow you to make sure you're following all the rules. And he fought that. He lost. He appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that they did not want to hear his case. So he will have to continue paying for those $700 a day at-sea monitors.
And what would that mean for the industry?
What would it mean for any industry? I mean, I couldn't imagine paying $700 a day to have somebody sitting over my shoulder making sure that I captured all the typos. I mean, that would be crazy.
He did tell our Jason Moon here at NHPR that, you know, it could be the end of the industry. It sounds dramatic, but it's one of many regulations for resource management in the Gulf of Maine that these fishermen – I think we've interviewed David Gothel numerous times over the years. He's one of a small number of commercial fishing fleet here in the state. It's days at sea restrictions here and there. I mean, it's not new. It's evolving, and we'll see how the stocks replenish.
He does have another option, which is to channel some of this energy in the Trump administration to get rid of regulations. And so he said he was going to write to the U.S. Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, to see if they could take a look at this regulation and see if they could get it tossed overboard, so to speak.
Well, the president has been big on saying we need to get rid of regulations that hamper business. Maybe this is a prime example of something he might want to do. Let's talk now about legislation that isn't even legislation yet. It was just a legislative service request, but a fascinating one. And it has to do with tax returns, specifically the tax returns of presidential candidates who run for office. Here in New Hampshire, before the first in the nation presidential primary, Democrat from Hebron, Suzanne Smith, is working to craft legislation that would require the disclosure of personal tax returns. And here's what she had to say on All Things Considered about whether there is political will inside the Republican-controlled legislature here to pass such legislation.
I mean, I have spoken to at least one Republican who said, I don't think tax returns will tell us anything, but I don't really agree with that. And there will be a lot of education involved on both sides of the aisle in between now and January, when the bill will be introduced into the committee.
Dean Spiliotis, what do you think about this type of requirement of making presidential candidates disclose their tax returns before the first in the nation primary?
It's really being driven by frustration over President Trump's unwillingness to turn over his tax returns. Throughout the 2016 campaign, a number of states, upwards of 30, have been looking into the possibility of requiring this in the future. There are some real constitutional issues involved in doing this. You know, in general, do tax returns make a big difference? Probably not, but certainly in the case of Trump, it would have given us a lot of information. And it's also the case, certainly at the presidential level, if Trump becomes kind of the new paradigm for, you know, very successful businessmen and people from other walks of life running for president with no prior experience, then you don't have quite the sort of history that you would have for somebody who's been an elected politician for a longer period of time. So this may become more relevant than it has been in the past. California has passed this in the state legislature. The Democratic governor, Jerry Brown, has not signed it yet or said where he stands. Interestingly enough, he refused to reveal his taxes for 2010 and 2014. So he's not necessarily a sure thing on this. So we'll see where it goes. I think it's going to be very difficult to legislate this and have it stand up to legal scrutiny.
Yeah, in New Hampshire, it's tough sledding with a Republican legislature as well. And the Secretary of State's office will testify on this bill. And who knows? It's one more bar for a candidate to meet to be on that ballot, besides their whopping $1,000 to get on the ballot, right?
Yeah, of course. And of course, the legislature, I imagine, is going to want to be very careful about treading on the Constitution, because the Constitution may in some way dictate that states can't place any additional regulations on candidates.
Right. I mean, and Dan brings up a great point, which is this Republican legislature has prioritized privacy in every instance. I mean, we've worked with them on all kinds of right-to-know issues, and privacy is a major issue, and not just for Republicans, but also for Democrats, too. So I don't see how – what type of bill that looks anything like this would be able to pass the House or the Senate.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been speaking with our guest today about the week's news. If you have insights or questions about a story or something you haven't heard in the week's news that you think should have been mentioned, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post your comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Let's talk about DCYF. That was in the news this week. An independent review of child abuse investigations that were closed by the state without following proper procedures has so far not turned up any problems, and that's according to Jeffrey Myers, Commissioner of Health and Human Services. Trent, remind us, what's the story behind those closed cases?
Here's the story. At a legislative hearing months ago, the former director of DCYF kind of hinted that 1,500 cases had been closed. The Monitor did some reporting, and they were able to dig up through right-to-know requests that they basically lifted most of the criteria that you need to regularly close a case, like, you know, calling parents, even checking on kids. They said, you know what, for 2 days, we're going to lift a lot of these safety protocols that we have so that we can administratively close a number of cases so we don't have as many on the books. So in those 2 days, they removed 1,500 cases from the books. After the story came out, I think it ran on a Sunday. Monday morning, the DCYF director was fired. She was put on administrative leave, and then
she was about to retire, but it was a few weeks before she retired.
Exactly. Yeah. But she was gone. After that story came out, she was no longer in charge of DCYF. The state brought in an outside group, a consulting firm, to come in and review these 1,500 pending cases to make sure that nothing dangerous happened, there were no outstanding issues in any of these cases. And so the new Commissioner of Health and Human Services, Jeffrey Myers, gave an update to the Oversight Commission on Children's Services about this review. The reviews cost about $85,000. He said only 598 cases were improperly closed, and that they were reviewing 100 of those cases. And so far, out of that small group, so the 100 of the 598, nothing improper has taken place. So I think we'll see. We have some questions left about this. How did we go from 1,500 to only 598? What's happening to all those other cases, about 900 other cases? Is anyone going to take a look at those? We have some questions that we're still planning to ask. But so far, according to this outside group, they have not found any issues.
Has this been an open process? In other words, have reporters been able to sort of ask specific questions like the ones you're just asking?
I wouldn't call it an open process. In my mind, an open process, these cases would be available for review. I would understand that the names of the children would have to be redacted, but that is not happening. We are basically just have to take Jeff Myers' word that this is happening, and we saw what happened with that last time. It didn't work so well.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Also in DCF news this week, the department is finally making progress on filling vacant social work positions. Trent, how many did they need to fill?
I think they need to fill 125 positions, and as of Tuesday, they had filled 103. Remember, these are very difficult positions to fill. You need specialized training. They can be very difficult. I mean, just think about what you're doing. You're going into really troubled homes, and you are serving as essentially a rock for these children, and getting in the middle of sometimes very bad situations. You're not paid well. A lot of the workers are part of the complaints that workers face there is that they don't have the technology they need. So a lot of them don't have smartphones or they don't have laptops. So they're out in the field and they may be working on three different cases at the same time, and they're trying to text from their, you know, Razor phone. It just doesn't work. So, you know, it's a difficult job, and they've really focused on filling those. And it sounds like they're just still looking for about 25 more people.
Mm-hmm. And also importantly, a position created by the legislature in the last session to provide independent oversight of DCYF has not yet been filled. Dean, what's that position, and when do officials expect to have it filled?
Yeah, this is a position that was created to kind of provide an independent or external advocate, a director of the Office of Child Advocate, and it's basically sort of an independent oversight of the process in order to sort of prevent a lot of the problems that Trent described. It had been a little bit slow going here, getting this up and running. The job posting was finally put up. The commission in charge of running this process is supposed to give, I believe, three names to the governor for nominations, and then take it from there. So they're finally making progress on it, but there have been some criticism that it was getting up a little slow in getting to this point.
Also in the news this week, Secretary of State Bill Gardner released dozens of documents related to his participation in a presidential commission on voting integrity. Responding to a right-to-know request from the New Hampshire Office of the American Civil Liberties Union, Dan, what do these documents reveal?
Well, it reveals that, you know, as Bill Gardner has told our Casey McDermott, he's doing this on his personal time. The documents, however, are from many staff members over at the Secretary of State's office. And there's really the question of, like, how much state time, taxpayer money here is being paid or used to fund this participation on the President's Election Integrity Commission. It's interesting. It's, you know, we had the September 12th was the meeting of the commission here in New Hampshire. Obviously, Bill Gardner sits on the commission. He's one of the most respected Secretary of States in the country, one of the longest serving. He finds himself in the crosshairs here in New Hampshire and around the country, really, for his participation on this committee because he is well respected.
Mm-hmm. And what were the nature of the documents that were released under this right to know request?
Well, it's really like how much time is being spent on this, you know, what Bill Gardner and others have sought for testimony or experts who sat in on the commission meeting, which was held, again, last month at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. And we'll find out. Casey's on the story. She's tenacious in her reporting. We'll figure out really what's next in terms of this commission and what it means here in New Hampshire.
And Dean, what do you make of the argument that Secretary of State Gardner made that he was serving on the commission as his personal capacity, not as Secretary of State necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, I see why he's making that distinction. I think in practice, as Dan is suggesting, that's very difficult, particularly when you have to rely on other staff in the office to help with scheduling or providing resources, et cetera. So, you know, I've been very skeptical of this commission to begin with. You know, whether we can really kind of separate out him individually from his role as Secretary of State, I think that's a little bit of a nuance, but that's the case he's making.
Yeah, there is. The executive order that the president signed does provide, I think it's up to $500,000 of funding through the General Services Administration for this commission and their staff members and whatnot, and, you know, the Secretary of State's travel expenses for going to D.C. or wherever. But these are all the related costs that we're questioning.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with NHPR's Dan Tuohy, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, and with you. If you've got questions about the week's news, please let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We'll learn more about the week's news in just a bit. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Call us with your questions about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Joseph Flynn, a Massachusetts state trooper accused of beating a man during a Nashua traffic stop, appeared in court this week. Trent, remind us about the story. What was the incident that landed him in court in the first place?
This was a chase that ended along Main Street in Nashua back in 2016. It was a chase that went on for 45 minutes, almost an hour. It was incredibly dangerous. At some points, the suspect, Richard Simone, was driving on the wrong side of the highway. When he finally stopped on kind of a dead-end road, police thought a couple of things are going to happen here. He's either going to shoot at us, commit suicide, or he's going to run away through this residential neighborhood where there are all kinds of schools are. And so it was heated. I remember watching it, and I remember thinking it was live on TV, and I remember thinking, man, this is not good. Something bad is going to happen. And what happened was he got out of the truck, and depending on who you ask, was essentially beat by a couple of officers as he was getting down to the ground. I remember watching it and thinking, wow, there are going to be criminal charges here. And there were. Two police officers were charged, one a New Hampshire state trooper who took a plea deal in exchange for no jail time. He lost his job and will never be able to serve in law enforcement again. But the Massachusetts state trooper who was involved in the incident, Joseph Flynn, decided that he wanted to go to trial, and his trial started this week. His lawyer's arguing that if you watch the video, and they're going to slow down the video for the jury so they can really see every second of what happened. If you watch the trial, this officer, Trooper Flynn, was in fear of something bad happening and was trying to make sure that he could see the suspect's hands. And so did he hit him? Yes. But he hit him on the shoulder, did not cause any major damage to the suspect, and was able to subdue him and get him under arrest. So they're asking for these charges, the assault charges, which are upped because he was on duty. They become felony level. They're asking for these charges to be dropped.
Mm-hmm. And the case also raised the issue of the helicopter footage, which is what a lot of us watched, and the ability to use that in the trial because that gives you kind of a bird's eye view of the whole encounter, which was sort of novel when the story first broke.
And part of what the trial strategy is to not just look at that helicopter video, because I watched the helicopter video, right? I'm not a juror, but I said, well, those guys are guilty. But what they're trying to say is, let's look at the entire chase. Let's look at everything that they have been trying to do to stop him. Here's this guy driving above the speed limit on the wrong side of 495. He could kill somebody. Here he is, like, refusing to stop for us. They did what's called a pit remover on maneuver on him, where they actually drive up behind him and they try and move his car so that it spins out and so that he stops. They tried to do that, I think, twice, and it wasn't successful. And then when he finally pulls over, they don't know what he's going to do. They don't know if he has a gun. They don't know, you know, we're now in a very dense residential area in Nashua, and they're concerned about other people's safety because for the 45 minutes they were in the chase, he didn't seem to care about anyone else's safety. So their argument is, yes, we used force on him, but it was an appropriate use of force because we had to detain him.
So what's the next step for this trial? Is it ongoing?
It's ongoing, and we, the union leaders covering it, will have all the news on it, and we'll have the verdict whenever it comes down.
All right. Okay. And also in the news this week, a completely different subject, but worth discussing. A high school senior says the private Christian school in New Hampshire that he attended since kindergarten told him he was no longer welcome because of his gender identity and suggested he get counseling. Dan, what's the story here?
Well, the story talks about this young man who says he was blocked from the school. Again, it was not a public school. He is at a newer school, and he's trying to bring the attention to what happened here. And the question remains, as Dean mentioned, I think, in the break, was this illegal? Did the school district do anything wrong?
What do you think, Dean?
Yeah, well, this is a Tri-Christian Academy. It's a religious school. I don't know what sort of contract they sign as a prerequisite for enrollment, but this student, Stiles Zuklag of Lebanon, Maine, says that was removed. Was basically told to stop transitioning, sort of a moral argument about the desire to do this. and that would have to leave as a result of it. So, you know, in my sense, I'm not a lawyer, but my sense is because it's a private institution, it doesn't have quite the same constraints that you might have in a public setting.
Any sense that there'll be legal action taken against the school? Or
That I don't know yet. I guess it's possible, but I have not read that yet.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been speaking with our guest today about the week's news. Give us a call with your questions. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, where the discussion continues, at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Dan, let's talk about Keno a little bit, because you know, the state legislature approved it, so long as towns go forward and vote to approve it, and the town of Franklin did this past week. So right. What does that mean for the town of Franklin? Going to have Keno machines in the bars and restaurants soon? Or?
Sure. Well, the city of Franklin approved it. It was, I think, a 60% margin, which is pretty impressive, even though there was, I understand, a lower turnout than expected. Some establishments, pouring establishments, those with a liquor license and meet the age requirement will pursue this. Some are, like cities elsewhere, wondering, what does this mean? What is involved? A licensed establishment does get 8% of the proceeds. So there is a financial incentive as well, not just helping out potential patrons to their establishment. It's one of those questions. I know Paige Sutherland talked to Charlie McIntyre, the lottery director, about what this means. And, you know, the interesting takeaway there for me was Charlie was saying that by the end of 2018, of those eligible places for Keno, 1 in 8 will have Keno, which is quite a huge figure in my estimation here.
Well, it was interesting to read the coverage. The bar and restaurant owners who were interested, they were sort of uniformly excited about the potential of bringing this in. People who oppose Keno would argue that, you know, Franklin has had a lot of economic challenges in recent years, and this is sort of precisely the kind of place where having this kind of gambling could cause additional problems. The same sort of argument you hear about, scratch tickets and sort of convenience store gambling targeting economically depressed areas. So it was interesting that this was the first place to jump on it. We'll see what kind of an economic windfall it provides, or if you see these other negative externalities as a result of having this gambling option right in the town.
Right. It was the first because of the nature of their municipal calendar. Other cities have it on the ballot.
It, yeah.
Right. Right. So, Manchester, Nashua, Berlin, some of these cities will be coming forward and voters will see it as well.
Cities, I understand, will vote on it in November. Towns on town meeting day in March next year?
Correct.
Okay. But for Franklin, the soonest they may see it is what, later this year, this fall, this winter?
According to our reporting, possibly later this year. I know December 15th was identified as a prospective date for at least one rollout. And towns and cities don't have to pursue it. The city of Portsmouth, they said thanks, but no thanks. And one of the councils over there has told NHPR that, there's no clamor in Portsmouth for Keno.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the criticism of how this Keno plan is working. Some of the criticism is that towns like that have been harder hit, like Berlin, Franklin, even Manchester, Nashua, they may approve Keno, but Bedford's not going to approve Keno, right? Portsmouth is not going to approve Keno. This is a way to pay for early childhood education, but some of the harder hit cities may end up paying more than some of the more affluent communities in the state.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the wildfire that has been burning in and around the White Mountain National Forest, keeping firefighters busy. The fire led to the closure of the Kinsman Ridge Trail area of the Appalachian Trail in North Woodstock. Trent, how bad is this fire?
It's pretty big. It's about 25 acres. It's pretty dramatic, too. A lot of the forest fires we see in New Hampshire are just kind of like smothering underbrush. But this one, because it's on such a steep grade, it was almost like something you might see out west. Trees on fire. There were two or three helicopters, including the National Guard's huge Black Hawk, sucking up water from nearby lakes and dumping it on the on the water. And because of where it is and because of how the winds were, a lot of people could smell it. We got a lot of phone calls from people driving up 93 and people who lived in the area who could smell it for miles. So this has been going on for a long time, and it's such a difficult type of fire because of the grade, because of the heat. It's so difficult that they think that it's going to be going for a while.
Mm-hmm. And there was some talk that this may have been caused by a meteor. What would that be?
It's an unknown cause of origin, right, as they say. It's under investigation. The fire chief up there has said, John McKay, the fire chief in Woodstock, said, you know, a passerby did tell them that, oh, yeah, that he saw a meteorite hit the ground there. We haven't identified the person, but that's highly unlikely, as we've read and we know from experts.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Right, because we've heard that meteors essentially, they don't get hot enough. Is that what we're hearing
Trent,
from
you're the expert?
We got some heat on this. We were the first ones to report
unintended,
the possibility.
Right?
Yes. So our reporter actually went there and was walking around with the crews and found the fire chief, who said, somebody told me they saw a meteor in the sky just a couple of minutes before this fire started. We have not been able to find any other cause. We think it's very unlikely that there are people there. I mean, the slope is about 60 degrees. So picture that. That's like walking up the steepest set of stairs that you've ever seen. And it's very rocky. And so they don't think that there was like somebody back there camping that was starting a fire. And they haven't been able to find another cause. So he just said, this may be a possibility. That was all we reported. This may be a possibility. Our dear friends at the Concord Monitor, sitting at overlooking the Merrimack River in front of their office, said, no, that there's no way that that's possible. It's not possible. Though they did quote a UNH astronomer who said in their story that while it is not likely, it's very improbable, there is a possibility that a meteor could have hit a rock and started a fire. So those are the facts.
We really enjoy it. We should all just get on the record saying we really enjoyed David Brooks' reporting at the Concord Monitor, because it was good. It was a good article, always bringing in the scientists to sort of set us straight, or at least allow for possibilities and throw in the probabilities, which is important to keep in mind. But last thing on this fire, though, has there been any loss of life or loss of property with it?
None.
And it's in an area where there's not it's not threatening any homes or highways or anything like that.
Okay, well that's really important to point out, and of course firefighters will still be working on keeping that fire under control and perhaps putting it out. So that should be it for today. I want to thank our panel of esteemed reporters and analysts, Dean Spiliotis of SNHU and the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's digital engagement producer, Dan Tuohy. Thank you guys very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Peter.
And just a reminder that we're going to be asking for your help for a show next week. On Wednesday, we'll be talking about gun control in the wake of the horrible massacre in Las Vegas. You can weigh in on this discussion by giving us a call now or sending us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. We always like hearing from you. Also, we just want to remind you that the conversation about this show continues online on Facebook or at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.